I'm going to be picking up from where Michael left off in certain respects. One is in the relation between literature and reportage, and between war and reportage, and between war and fact, and literature of fact. Another is, as it happens, to do with proxy wars. And here I'm going to take issue with him because you remember he argued that 1945 saw the beginning of a whole series of proxy wars. I don't think he actually said that there hadn't been any before, but I'd like to suggest that from one point of view, the Spanish Civil War, in which Orwell fought and about which he wrote, was a proxy war, and I'll explain why in just a second. But of course, in another sense, I'm not following on from Michael because he dealt with the period 1945 and later, and I'm returning to the chronology of the module, and we're back in the 30s. The Spanish Civil War it was extremely complicated, and there are some handouts at the front here if you need a handout, or there were. They're there. Handouts. There are some people at the back there who haven't got them. They're making their way around vaguely. Any other handouts? Anybody who hasn't got a handout and who can't find one by the end, I'll be putting some in the rack outside my office, H526. But it looks as if there are at least some there. Spanish Civil War was extremely complicated, but it suited people, as in the case of all wars, to simplify it. And one of the things about writing about war is that, at its best, it restores the complexity to a situation which enmity and propaganda have tried to simplify. The simple version of the Spanish Civil War is broadly accurate, at least as I'll describe it, but bear in mind that it was much more complicated than this, and some of those complications will come through as I talk. I'm not just going to be talking about the Spanish Civil War because I'll be talking about Orwell as an essayist, but because this section of the module is about war, that is where my main emphasis will lie. The broad picture was this, a Republican government, that's to say an anti-monarchy, democratically elected government, came in Spain in the early 1930s. It instantly introduced a number of reforms which were very dramatic and controversial. They may seem to us completely just now, but in politics it's not just a matter of what's right, but a matter of what can be withstood, what people will put up with. And the Republicans introduced, among other things, extensive land reforms, which said if you don't live on your land and don't use your land, it'll be taken off you and given to other people who will work it. Now, Spain was still a practically medieval feudal state in the 1930s in relation to land owning. The vast majority of the land was owned by a tiny percentage of people. And although it was right and just that those people should recognize the inequality of the situation and that something should be done to balance things out, threatening them so abruptly with the loss of thousands of acres of land, which they had always, in inverted commas, owned, was bound to cause a reaction, and so it did. In 1936, there was an armed uprising against the democratically elected Republican government, and it was an uprising, as so often is the case, of a coalition of church, landowners, and other very rich people, and the military. And it was led by a military man called Franco, who became the dictator. Franco had his, these are the two other important points I want to make in relation to the Civil War. Franco had his training and his military successes as a colonial soldier. Spain owned, again in inverted commas, a large chunk of Morocco. Morocco was in a state of rebellion against Spanish imperialism there. The Spanish army was busily engaged in trying to quell those insurrections. And it was there that Franco had his great military successes, which included enlisting Moroccan troops as mercenaries on the Spanish side, mercenaries meaning people who fought for money, irrespective of what side they were fighting on. So when Franco led the army of the rebel army against the Republicans in Spain, his mindset was that of a man who was fighting an insurgent enemy on hostile territory. The fact that he was fighting against his own countrymen on their own territory was not primarily in his mind. It also, given his formation and background, he used a lot of Moroccan mercenaries in the course of the war. You have to think about this in terms of Spanish history for at least seven centuries until the early Renaissance period. Spain had been a Muslim state ruled from end to end by primarily North African Muslims. In what the Spanish call the Reconquest, the Reconquista, they had expelled bit by bit the Muslims from Spain and or forced them to convert to Christianity. Ferdinand and Isabella, who were the king and queen at that time, also had a systematic program of expulsion or forced conversion of Jews. This was to transform Spain from what had previously been a highly successful multicultural society into a narrow, isolated country quite different from many other European states. Part of its mythology was that one day the North Africans might come back. This was feared and dreaded by some people. So that when North African troops began to arrive and as mercenaries in 1936, those fears resurfaced. What I'm trying to suggest is that this was a colonial war against the country itself. The second point about Franco is that in 1939, he was the victor of the Spanish Civil War, and he stayed in power until 1973, when he died. So in the case of Spain, it's rather as if the Second World War had been won by the wrong side, as if Hitler had gone on in power until the 1970s, or Mussolini had gone on in power until the 1970s. This returns me to the point about the Spanish Civil War as a proxy war. As soon as Franco and his generals rose against democracy, the trial totalitarian regimes, the young, as yet militarily untested regimes of Italy and Germany, were the first to come in support. Germany and Italy both lent not only material, weapons, tanks, planes, but troops. They were actively involved on the rebel side, the military and aristocratic side, against the Republic at the beginning of the war. By the same token, the Republicans were very soon joined by communist troops, communist material, and communist skills, so that not only the Second World War, but in a sense the subsequent Cold War, was being fought out in Spain between 1936 and 1939. A proxy war then, but also, I would argue, the beginning of the Second World War. It's often described as a rehearsal for the Second World War. I think of it as the first act of the Second World War. But you can take an even wider view. Some historians today talk about the period 1914 to 1945, the whole period, 1914 to 1945, as the period of the European Civil War. The European Civil War, and it's interesting to think about it in that connection. Now, George Orwell was an established writer, novelist, journalist, when he volunteered for the International Brigades, which were a body of people who, as the name suggests, came from all over the world to fight on the side of the Republic against the rebels who came to call themselves nationalists, to the great irritation of the Republicans, who didn't think they were any less nationalist in support of Spain than the other side. The International Brigades were a volunteer body of people who fought for the Republic. A number of writers and artists joined them. I'll come back to that in a moment. but the majority were working men and some working women. Some of them were unemployed, some of them were trade unionists, but they were generally people who had grown up in an atmosphere of socialism and of the romance of the Russian Revolution. And it's really important, given everything we know now about Stalin, to remember that the Russian Revolution at the time and on into the 30s and even later seemed to many people to be the embodiment of a new culture, a new fairness, a new internationalism in which everybody would have what was due to them and nobody would have what wasn't due to them. That there was, it wasn't only, it became a totalitarianism and an oppressive disaster, but it started out as an idealistic dream. And it was people who had that dream in their mind, in many cases, who went to fight on behalf of the Republic in the international brigades. Orwell was not quite as idealistic as that. His motives were complicated, as most people's motives are, and I'll come back to that. But let me take you straight in now to an episode in the middle of the Spanish Civil War. Orwell had been quite seriously wounded and was on his way home to England. And he discovered on the way that one of the officers under whom he had been serving, fighting for the elected government against the military rebels, had been taken prisoner. To complicate things, and I said the Spanish Civil War was complicated, and you'll have to follow this quite closely to understand it, the captors of that officer were not the military rebels against whom, the fascists, against whom he and Orwell had been fighting, but the Republican government itself, which by this stage was increasingly behaving as if Spain were an outpost of Stalinist Russia and had been comprehensively infiltrated by Stalinist advisors and troops. I say comprehensively infiltrated. That applies to some bits of the Republican army and aspects of the Republican government. But you need to know that there were many factions on both sides. When we first got a coalition in the UK, an awful lot of heads were shaken about whether coalitions worked, with examples from elsewhere in Europe. But if you think about it, any politics is a matter of coalitions. The Labour Party is not a monolithic body of people, all of whom have identical views. It's a loose coalition of people who agree to follow certain policies but will argue about them, and who range between many different positions. So is the Conservative Party, so is the Liberal Party. So for two parties to form a coalition is simply for them to add to the nature of what parties are intrinsically. So it was in the Spanish Civil War. There was a group called the Party of Unification of Marxist Workers. Orwell and the imprisoned officer both belonged to that and were fighting on its side. Some animal trying to get in. But while the government was using that party's troops, it's called POUM, Partido Obrero de Unificación Marxista, it was actually quietly imprisoning and executing key members of it in the cities. It was using the troops, but bumping off the leadership. This was because that party was not, in the view of the Stalinists, adequately towing the line. Now, the officer whose name was Kopp, who had been imprisoned, wasn't told why he had been imprisoned. And all his papers were taken from him by the police. Among the papers was a letter from the Ministry of War which made clear that he was a key military commander on the Republican side. Now, Orwell managed, remember on his way home from being wounded, managed to visit him in prison and realized that this document was absolutely crucial, that his friend, the officer Cobb, was going to be executed unless he, Orwell, could get hold of this letter and prove that he was on the right side. His narrative of this appears on the first page of the handout. Everybody got the handout now? Are there some spare copies? No spare if there are spare copies, would you mind bringing them down here for later on? Don't worry about it now. I saw instantly, this is the paragraph about 10 lines down, how important this letter might be. An official letter of that kind, bearing the recommendation of the Ministry of War and of General Pothas, would establish Kopp's bona fides, the fact that he was okay. But the trouble was to prove that the letter existed. If it were opened in the chief of police's office, one could be sure that some narc or other would destroy it. There was only one person who might possibly be able to get it back, and that was the officer to whom it was addressed. Kopp had already thought of this, and he had written a letter which he wanted me to smuggle out of the jail and post. But it was obviously quicker and surer to go in person. I left my wife with Kopp, Orwell's wife had come out to take him home, rushed out, and after a long search, found a taxi. I knew that time was everything. It was now about 5:30. The colonel would probably leave his office at 6, and by tomorrow the letter might be God knew where, destroyed perhaps or lost somewhere in the chaos of documents that was presumably piling up as suspect after suspect was arrested. The colonel's office was at the War Department down by the quay. As I hurried up the steps, the assault guard on duty at the door barred the way with his long bayonet and demanded papers. I waved my discharge ticket at him. Evidently he couldn't read, and he let me pass, impressed by the vague mystery of papers. Inside, the place was a huge, complicated warren running round a central courtyard with hundreds of offices on each floor, and, as this was Spain, nobody had the vaguest idea where the office I was looking for was. I kept repeating, "The Colonel, Chief of the Engineers, the Army of the East." People smiled, shrugged their shoulders gracefully. Everyone who had an opinion sent me in a different direction, up these stairs, down those, along interminable passages which turned out to be blind alleys, and time was slipping away. I had the strangest sensation of being in a nightmare. The rushing up and down flights of stairs, the mysterious people coming and going, the glimpses through open doors of chaotic offices with papers strewn everywhere and typewriters clicking and time slipping away and a life, perhaps, in the balance. Well, it could be a scene from Kafka. It's very like a lot of Kafka's novel, The Trial. And later, Orwell did write two of the most Kafkaesque of British novels, Animal Farm, 1945, and 1984, which was published in 1949. The difference, of course, is that the passage I've read, which is from Homage to Catalonia, isn't fiction. And Orwell's reasons for writing that book were precisely that fiction, in his fears, might come to overwhelm truth. Fiction in the form of propaganda, which is one of the main fictional products of war. And he makes these fears explicit in one of the essays that he wrote, which is called Looking Back on the Spanish War. It's on page 4 of the handout on the left-hand side. And he wrote it a few years after he got back, but in the middle of the Second World War, 1942-3, he wrote it. Top left on page 4. Notice not only what he's saying, but the way he says it, the simplicity, almost the talkativeness of the way he writes. It will never be possible to get a completely accurate and unbiased account of the Barcelona fighting because the necessary records do not exist. Future historians will have nothing to go upon except a mass of accusations and party propaganda. I myself have little data beyond what I saw with my own eyes and what I've learned from other eyewitnesses whom I believe to be reliable. This kind of thing is frightening to me because it often gives me the feeling that the very concept of objective truth is fading out of the world. After all, the chances are that those lies, or at any rate similar lies, will pass into history. The implied objective of this line of thought is a nightmare world in which the leader, capital L, taking us forward to Animal Farm and 1984, in which the leader or some ruling clique controls not only the future but the past. If the leader says of such and such an event, it never happened, well, it never happened. If he says that 2 and 2 are 5, well, 2 and 2 are 5. All art claims to be more true in one way or another than received versions of truth. But Such claims are always particularly strong in times when propaganda is in the ascendant, propaganda or mythology, and wars, as I said before, are such times. The American poet Wallace Stevens, whose dates I think I give you here, 1870, that's on page one again, sorry to go to and fro, 1879 to 1955, wrote what became known as a prose statement on the poetry of war. It was poetry of war we were talking about last time. Wallace Stevens was a poet, and what he wrote in prose was, "The immense poetry of war and the poetry of a work of the imagination are two different things. In the presence of the violent reality of war, consciousness takes the place of imagination. And consciousness of an immense war is a consciousness of fact. If that is true, it follows that the poetry of war, as a consciousness of the victories and defeats of nations, is a consciousness of fact." And so he goes on, and then he gets into the question of heroism. But it's that point that I want to get at and to leave with you at the end of this lecture. The question of whether the literature of war, the art of war, is ultimately art of fact rather than of the imagination. The immense poetry of war takes over as a consciousness of fact. Now, as I said, I'm going to be focusing both on Homage to Catalonia and on Orwell's essays. But first of all, I just want to make some wider points. Some of this is related clearly to discussions that are going on in our time about faction, about the questions that arise when people in documentaries, in TV programs, films, novels, put a fictional spin on factual events, but present them in a documentary way so that people think that what they're getting is something absolutely factual. Now, at one level, this is absolutely straightforward. Writers and artists in the 1930s and 40s were increasingly interested in the power of facts in themselves, the imaginative power of facts. Artists, too. You think about the found object, the objet trouvé. You find a bit of wood on a beach and you present it in a particular way and it looks like a sculpture. Think of collage, which puts together pieces of unimportant seeming material, bus tickets, maps, a letter, and makes a work of art out of them. Writers were interested in that. And we've already spoken of imaginative writers who were precursors of this movement, particularly William Carlos Williams. And it might seem logical that the next step from poetry of fact or art of fact would be to dispense with the idea of beauty, to dispense with aestheticism, and to focus solely on whether something is true. Let me give you a sort of test case of this, which is a poem about the Second World War by somebody who trained actually as a visual artist. This is page two of the handout on the left, a poem called "These Are Facts." And the writer is Scottish, and his first name is pronounced Riven, although it's spelt Ruthven, Riven Todd. And he's writing in 1940 to 41 about the fact that St. Paul's Cathedral had survived an enormous air raid during the Blitz at the beginning of the Second World War, early in the Second World War. St. Paul's Cathedral had survived, but a lot of the houses around in the East End of London had been destroyed. And all the news in the papers the next day was to do with the survival of St. Paul's as a symbol, as a heroic fact, and pictures of St. Paul's, and you can still see them if you look on the web, with clouds of smoke and dust around it, but untouched among all the ruins that had been caused by the bombing. And Todd is in revulsion and reaction against this propaganda and is saying, what the hell does St. Paul's matter by comparison with people's lives and houses and homes? These are facts, is what the poem is called. These are facts. Observe them how you will. Forget for a moment the medals and the glory, the clean shape of the bomb designed to kill, and the proud headlines of the paper's story. Remember the walls of brick that 40 years had nursed to make a neat though shabby home, the impertinence of death ignoring tears that smashed the house and left untouched the dome. Bodies in death are not magnificent or stately. Bones are not elegant that blast has shattered. This sorry, stained, and crumpled rag was lately a man whose life was made of little things that mattered. Now he's just a nuisance, liable to stink, a breeding ground for flies, a test tube for disease. Bury him quickly and never pause to think what is the future worth to men like these. People are more than places, more than pride. A million photographs record the work of Wren. A city remains a city on credit from the tide that flows among its rocks, a sea of men. Well, it's very much of its time and its emphasis on human beings, on individuals, and on the people who in a hierarchical society are not deemed to count. It's trying to assert a value system based on facts rather than aesthetics. Bodies in death are not magnificent. Bones are not elegant. But against, despite the fact that he's writing against elegance, against aestheticism, against valuing works of art and architecture over human beings, he's actually writing a poem which depends on quite traditional notions of aesthetic value and form. It's a very traditional poem, the very regular meter. It's rhymed A-B-A-B. And something you might want to think about is whether there's a paradox in that. The fact that he hasn't written, as it were, a poem made of bricks and ugliness. He's written a beautiful poem about being wary of aesthetic values. Now, Orwell was very aware of the fact that in order to work, literature depends on the aesthetic. It depends on being able to attract readers to itself through the way in which words are put together and shaped. And in another essay called Why I Write, published in 1946, he makes this absolutely clear. It's on the same page as the Riven Todd poem over on the right at the top. Every line of serious work that I've written since 1936, that's the beginning of the Spanish Civil War, has been written directly or indirectly against totalitarianism and for democratic socialism as I understand it. It seems to me nonsense in a period like our own to think that one can avoid writing of such subjects. Everyone writes of them in one guise or another. It is simply a question of what side one takes and what approach one follows. What I have most wanted to do throughout the past 10 years is to make political writing into an art. My starting point is always a feeling of partisanship, a sense of injustice, but I could not do the work of writing a book or even a long magazine article if it were not also an aesthetic experience. I could not do the work of writing a book or even a long magazine article if it were not also an aesthetic experience. One of the things, the important things that he's saying there, and it was much more original to say it in 1946 than it is today, is that a magazine article can be a work of literature. Now, there are various writers that I want to add to what Orwell's saying here, which come from Orwell himself. It's important to bear in mind, for example, that he always knew and stressed that there can be good art about bad subjects and by bad people, and vice versa. Much of the literary criticism he wrote was actually a defense of individuality in art against the conformist pressures of what would now be called political correctness. So he found merit, for example, in Kipling and Henry Miller and P.G. Wodehouse, all of whom were objected to on various moral or political grounds. P.G. Wodehouse, the comic writer, for example, because he stayed in France and effectively collaborated with the Nazis in the Second World War. Being on the right side, being on the right side and telling the truth about what the right is isn't the only thing that matters in literature, is Orwell's point. Now, prose of the kind that Orwell wrote is, I would argue, much more definitive of and expressive of the wars of the mid-20th century than poetry. Michael Hulse gave us a very moving example of a very powerful Second World War poem in the case of Celan's Death Fugue, written in German. And there are great poems of the Second World War. And there were many poets of that time. But prose was the overwhelmingly stronger medium. And a lot of that prose was overtly interested in recording, in getting down on the page, factual analysis and above all observation. This was the period, the 1930s and 40s were the period, for example, of a movement called mass observation. And the title page of one of Mass Observation's publications is reproduced on the fourth page of the Xerox. You see it's distinctively period typography and its plain style there. The subtitle of Mass Observation, which was a pioneering early form of sociology, which was an academic discipline developed at this time, was The Science of Ourselves. That was the subtitle of Mass Observation, The Science of Ourselves. It was an overtly populist set of publications, and it depended on talking to people and writing down ordinary people in the street, vox pop interviews, if you like, asking people what they thought, getting down their reactions. And it was pioneered by two socialists who had anthropological training, but one of them also a background as a poet. One was called Charles Madge, and one of them was called Thomas Harrison. I've given their name on the handout. Both of them, incidentally, and I mentioned this in connection with Living, talking about Henry Green, came from upper-class backgrounds and public school educations, and a large part of what motivated them was wanting to a mixture of simple curiosity about what it was like to come from a different background from their own, and guilt about it, and wanting to redress that guilt. This was true of Orwell, too, who had been at Eton with Henry Green. They were contemporaries at Eton. And where Henry Green went to work in his family's factory and really tried to convey a true picture of what it was like to be a working-class person in that factory, Orwell went around living broke and experiencing what it was like to live in a doss house or to have absolutely the poorest casual work in a hotel in France, generally experiencing at first hand the kind of life which his upbringing had not provided him with and putting it down. The results of that were two books, one of them called Down and Out in Paris and London, which was published in 1933, and the other was called The Road to Wigan Pier in 1937. And then off he went to Spain and again was fighting as a volunteer soldier, but also writing very closely about what it was like to be a soldier, to be an ordinary soldier in a battle which, put in the simplest terms, was a battle of working people against the ruling class. Or a battle in which the ruling class had risen up against and were trying to crush the new power of working people. As I said, he was one of many people who went to fight in Spain, and they had very different motives and reasons. It's worth mentioning, by the way, that they weren't all on the Republican side. People volunteered to fight on the rebel ruling class side. But the majority of the international volunteers were on the Republican side. Interestingly, something I didn't know until recently, a number of black Americans had wanted to volunteer for the war in Ethiopia, which had happened earlier in the 1930s, when Italy had invaded Ethiopia, which was then Abyssinia. And this was seen as a colonial war against black people. And black Americans had wanted to go and fight in Ethiopia against the Italians. And the Americans had prevented them from having visas, so they hadn't been able to go. And almost as if to use that pent-up energy, there was a whole battalion of black Americans fighting in the Spanish Civil War on the Republican side. And they were they managed to get them through by sending them to France first, saying they were going to France as tourists, and getting them down through France into Spain. Many different motives, many different histories to these individuals. One of them was the internationalism that came from Marxist revolutionary beliefs. Part of the creed of communism was that we are all brothers and sisters, whatever country we come from, so that if some harm is being done to people in one country, it's up to people in another to go and help them. That nationalism is an antiquated and morally unsound belief. And you don't have to think very hard about the food we eat and the way we live and what that depends on in terms of global inequalities and the people who are doing the work to give us that food for wages which wouldn't last us an hour, to see what that's all about. But there were other reasons to do with going to war, which included adventurousness, just wanting to go and see what it was like. And a connection with that was the fact that there was a very strong feeling among the generation which had missed the First World War, especially males who had been young during the First World War and whose elder brothers or fathers or other male relatives had fought, that they had somehow not been tested, that they just because of their age had missed something which they needed to be able to prove that they were brave enough to do. What does it actually mean to face shellfire? And Orwell had all of these reasons for taking part. But he had another one too, which was very pragmatic. He wrote, "When I joined the militia, I had promised myself to kill one fascist. After all, if each of us," meaning the Republicans, "killed one, they would soon be extinct." Orwell has that very sometimes shocking baldness in his way of writing about things sometimes. He tries to get down to the absolutely simple, basic statement. But you have to be careful reading him, because he likes to provoke, he likes to shock. He was an early version of the columnist who is trying to arouse a reaction in the newspaper reader. And he was also somebody who had, as I said, he had a public school education, and his first job after he left school was in the Burmese police. In other words, he was part of the British-trained semi-army of occupation, which ruled and governed a colonial country. And there are some times when his writing about war kind of hints at a background in which what he's thinking about is sort of going out to bag a few tigers. That he doesn't quite escape the accents of his time and of his immediate predecessors. Now, I began with the notion that literature of war, or I almost began with the notion that literature was above all literature of fact. And I'm going to show in a moment that much of what Orwell wrote fits that description. But Homage to Catalonia, his book about the Spanish Civil War, has another thing in common with his essays, which is that it's also literature of analysis and of argument. It's divided in a really very mechanical way. The chapters alternate between chapters which are about first-hand experience of what was going on in the war as seen by Orwell, and chapters which put all that into a political, historical context. And he says at the outset, if you're not interested in all that, it's quite complicated, you can skip it. So you can read Homage to Catalonia, missing out every other chapter, and you get the human story, the factual story, or you can read it the other way and you get the political, analytical story, or you can get both. I'm not going to go into the details of that, but he's unusual among war writers in having a pretty clear grasp of both sides of what it means to write about such a situation. There's no denying, though, that what readers today most want from Homage to Catalonia and from Orwell's essays when they're concerned with, as it were, news stories, is this graphic, unsentimental, vivid getting down of what it's like to be there, unadorned, fluent but plain, and that derives, in his case, from an interest in unexpected facts, but still facts. Facts such as that ambulances were shelled by both sides in the war. Ambulances were shelled by both sides, he says, justifiably, for in modern war, no one scruples to use an ambulance to carry ammunition. Or, he says, there's another fact as he sees it. When an aeroplane swoops down and uses its machine gun, the sound from below is like the fluttering of wings. You see that interest? He wants to get what it's like. It's like the sound of the machine gun is like the fluttering of wings. Or, he says, when you are watching artillery fire from a safe distance, you always want the gunner to hit his mark. Again, you have to be aware of that you in Orwell. It engages you and ropes you in. He does it a lot in his arguments. It gets you on his side. And then you think, what have I signed up to? You know, maybe I wouldn't want that. You always want the gunner to hit his mark, even though the mark contains your dinner and some of your comrades, he says. You always want the gunner to hit the mark, even though the mark contains your dinner and some of your comrades. Another example is his description of really a small classic of vivid suspense of a night attack by a couple of dozen volunteers, including himself, on a fascist position only reachable through thick mud, but which they had to reach without making any noise. And it's full of the kind of unsensational observed detail that makes you wince as if you were actually there. The way that when they're very near their target and the fascists open fire on them at close range, fear makes him and the others misaim their grenades. They've got grenades, they're well armed, they're going to throw them, and that would stop the people shooting at them because they would have been killed. But the very physical fact of fear means they miss their aim or throw them short. And his impulse running under fire across exposed land to cover the side of his face with his hand. He says it's an idiotic gesture, as though one's hand could stop a bullet, but I had a horror of being hit in the face. That kind of vividness. And all that comes to a kind of climax in his writing, in his description of being hit by a bullet, which starts on page 2 of the handout, which I'm not going to read, but perhaps you'll read afterwards in connection with your reading of the essays. But it begins... The whole experience of being hit by a bullet is very interesting, and I think it's worth describing in detail. It's that sort of detachment, the whole experience of being hit by a bullet is very interesting. And then he goes into it in very close detail, describing his own wounding. Now, much of Orwell's work began as journalism, as I've already hinted at, whether as reportage or as argument. And some of his essays subsequently went into books. So there's an essay called The Spike, which you may have read, which is about living in a hostel for homeless men, which turns up again in slightly different form in Down and Out in Paris and London. But the essays have other important dimensions, and I want to turn to those as part of these last 10 minutes, because it's the essays that you're reading, and they're not all about war, although, of course, they happen to coincide in large part. Orwell died only about 5 years after the end of the Second World War with that period, so that it tends to lend a lot to his subject matter. The first point I want to make about them is that they contain a lot of serious literary criticism. He was a reader and a writer. He was the literary critic of a left-wing paper, literary editor of a left-wing paper. And from your point of view, as students of, among other things, modernism, it's worth noticing his very astringent comments on high modernism, both in the 1943 essay on Yeats and a little earlier in Inside the Whale, where he tackles head-on the question of the relationship or lack of it between good writing and politics. This is on page 3 of the handout, bottom right-hand corner. He's been talking about Eliot and Joyce, among others, and he says, what's noticeable about all these writers, that he's writing in 1940, so the perspective he's writing from is important. What's noticeable about all these writers is that what purpose they have is very much up in the air. There's no attention to the urgent problems of the moment. Above all, no politics in the narrower sense. Our eyes are directed to Rome, to Byzantium, to Montparnasse, to the subconscious, to the solar plexus, to everything, the solar plexus is the navel, to everything except the places where things are actually happening. When one looks at the 20s, looks back at the 20s, nothing is queerer than the way in which every important event in Europe escaped the notice of the English intelligentsia. The Russian Revolution, for instance, all but vanishes from the English consciousness between the death of Lenin and the Ukraine famine about 10 years. Throughout these years, Russia means Tolstoy, he means in the writing of Anglophone writers. Russia means Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and exiled counts driving taxi cabs. Italy means picture galleries, ruins, churches, and museums, but not black shirts. Germany means films, nudism, and psychoanalysis, but not Hitler, of whom hardly anyone had heard until 1931. In cultured circles, art for art's saking extended practically to a worship of the meaningless. Literature was supposed to consist only in the meaning of words. Very challenging analysis, characteristically combative, and certainly one from which, from some of whose details Orwell would have backed off if challenged, but still a very useful thing to for you as a way into some of your thinking about those writers. One of the things he's forgetting, of course, is, because he's a journalist, is that on the whole, big experiences, historical experiences and events take a while to get digested into the arts. Dickens's A Tale of Two Cities is about the French Revolution, but it appeared 70 years after it in 1859. War and Peace, which appeared in 1865 to 72, is about Napoleon's invasion of Russia. But again, it's written and appears 50 years or more after that event. And the same is true today. If you think of the number of novels and movies that come out set in the Second World War, this is an experience that's still being digested, still being recreated for us, and which seems to matter to us imaginatively. So there are times when Orwell, in his comments on literature, mistakes literature for journalism, in terms of requirements like deadlines and contemporaneity. His other criteria include the kind of directness which he himself turned into an art. He has little time for the oblique ways in which events seeped into the wasteland, shall we say. But his piece is journalism, and it's published in a version of the spirit of that day. Another way in which Orwell's essays are important is, and I should say that among the ways that he writes irreverently, sometimes he's really onto something and says something that is very memorable and worth its immediacy. He talks about W.H. Auden, a poem by W.H. Auden about the Spanish Civil War, in which Auden talked about the necessary murder. And he said, Mr. Auden's brand of amoralism is only possible if you are the kind of person who's always somewhere else when the trigger is fired. A phrase that's worth bearing in mind. But the other way in which he's important, and I'm going to end here and I won't be very long, is in opening up the range of what could be written about seriously and intellectually. He wrote about Donald McGill's postcards, about boys' comics, about English cooking, about best-selling fiction, about sport. Cultural studies, in other words, things that today we think naturally anybody would write about and be interested in, but which in those times when the arts were still thought of very hierarchically were not written about seriously. And he's also one of the founders of literary post-colonialism, of a hard, clear look at what colonialism means in practice in those essays like Shooting an Elephant, Marrakesh, or the third section of The Lion and the Unicorn. Finally, in returning to his writing about war, which is what this section of the module is about and is where we'll be going to in the next couple of weeks, I'd just like to point out that he distills one of the essential paradoxes of war, that it applies the most sophisticated inventions of the human mind to destroying humanity. As I write, he says in his essay, England, Your England, it's the beginning of that essay, as I write, highly civilized beings are flying overhead trying to kill me. The clash between civilization and barbarism, the fact that not only are the pilots of those planes civilized, educated people, otherwise they wouldn't have been pilots, but the very machines they're flying are one of the highest developments of the human mind and inventiveness up to that point, and that what they're being used for is to try to kill other people in what was, as I suggested earlier, in some historical views, itself a civil war, the European Civil War of 1914 to 1945. Okay, I'll leave you with that and see you again next week. Thanks.